Okay, this week on Sunday night, you know, with the right after Milchama Erev and Meshul, typically there's a line of people coming to get tzedakah checks and things like that. So one of the fellows that came to normally they just tell me what the problems are and what the issue is and why they need two checks and not one check. You know, like you know, there's a normal dance that we do, I guess. But one of the fellows said, "How many mitzvahs are in this week's parsha?" Like, oh, there's a bechina now, you know. Like, I honestly didn't know the exact number. How many mitzvahs are in this week's parsha? Anyone know?
70.
Exactly.
What? I think like better.
Be'erach, yeah. I don't know. Is that the exact number? Is according to Sefer Chinuch? Yeah, I don't know. So anyway, there are a lot. There are a lot. It's definitely a parsha that's rich in mitzvos. A significant percentage of the halacha and the lamdos that are learned in our yeshiva years comes from Parshas Mishpatim. I mean, if you know, as someone once remarked, if you know the Rashis and Parshas Mishpatim really well, if you do those Rashi Bechina things, right? If you know the Rashis and Parshas Mishpatim really well, you're halfway toward being a Talmud Chacham already, right? And Rashi famously comments that this Parsha is so laden with all the details of civil law, and it's juxtaposed with Kabbalah Satorah and the Aseres Adibros, to highlight Maharishona Misinai Af Elu Misinai, that everything is from Har Sinai, even the things that you would think, you know, any just society can come up with some system of monetary law. So, okay, that makes sense. So even so, even with that backdrop, the choice of the very first of the civil laws that are described is somewhat of a surprising choice. You know, you would think that the most common one would come first, in Kesef Talve, right? People borrow money all the time, they lend money all the time, right? You would think that that would be the most, the first one to come up, or that which is most critical to the day-to-day functioning of society, which is probably also Kesef Talve. But meaning the point is, you would think that it's something like that, that would come first. But why start with the Jewish version of Avdus? With the concept of Eved Ivri. Eved Ivri is apparently meant to be symbolic on some level. So that's question number one. Secondly, Rashi writes that the expression Ve'la Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem intends to convey the thoroughness with which these halachos had to be taught. Don't even have a havamina, Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, to say, yeah, I'll teach it two or three times till they know it, you know, a little bit of chazara, but I'm not going to bother myself to explain the basis of all the halachos. Uperusho, lekach nemar, Asher tasim lefneim, kishulchan ha'aruch u'muchan le'echol lefnei adam. Not enough to just teach them the basic halachos a few times till they know it. They need to know what it's based on. They need to see how the halacha develops. They need to know how it works. You need to explain it to them well. So the question is, you know, certainly from the perspective of, you know, people who learn, right, we can ask the question, like, what's the hava amina? Right, I used to, point out that I always mention whenever I'm asked to give, like, a halacha shir, which is fairly often. I always mentioned, like, when I was teaching in halacha in DRS, I would always come in on the first day and say, like, okay, how many of you in the class is your favorite subject in the whole world, halacha, right? And nobody, no high school student is going to raise his hand, unless he's doing it ironically, you know, to be funny or whatever. That's how you identify the class clown, right? Meaning, and why is that? Because the way it was often taught to them was that just a list of dinim, like before each yantav, these are the dinim you need to know. That's obvious. I don't want to teach us halacha. That's not the way halacha is meant to be taught. It's not like, okay, you got to do this, got to do that, can't do that, can't do that. No one's ever going to, no one's going to connect to that. But when things make sense to people, and it's like, oh, there's a pasuk, and there's a Torah Shebal Peh, and there's a Machlokas Rishon, and this is how it plays out in halacha, and there's somewhere that it comes from. Like when things are fit into a framework, obviously it's going to be something that's more lasting and something that's more meaningful to people. What is the hava amina? What's the eshnolem aperik vahalacha bezo gimel pamim ashrei stur b'fiyam? That was the, you know, what to strive for. Why would Moshe have assumed on his own that people didn't require a detailed understanding of the halachos and the basis of the halachos? And the third question, going back to the Eved Ivri. After 6 years in servitude, if the Eved decides that he'd rather stay, he's allowed to. V'im amar yomar ha'Eved, ahavti es adoni es ishti v'es banai, lo etzei chavshi. I'm happy with my life. My master's good to me. He gives me, food to eat. He gives me a bed to sleep on. My wife, not so bad. Being married to a Shivcha Knan is, now I even have children now. Okay, lo yitzei chavshi. I don't want to go anywhere. So the Gemara in Kiddushim Chav Beis says that it's Omar Yomer, the im Omar Yomer Eved, a double lashon. If he says, so the Gemara derives that the Eved actually has to say it twice. He has to make that declaration twice. Not enough to say it once. He has to say it once when he's in Avdus, and then again when he faces his freedom. And it's evident where Chazal saw that requirement in the text, right? Omar Yomer, it has a double lashon. So Chazal picked up on that. They're not going to miss that, right? Obviously, they're going to say, okay, you see from here that there needs to be an Amira, Agabe Amira. You need two Amiras. So that makes a lot of sense. But what's not as evident is why the Torah in the first place imposed such a requirement that he has to say it twice. Wouldn't saying it once do the trick, right? Shouldn't that? Even if there were a concern that he didn't mean it, why insist that one declaration take place while still in the throes of slavery and the other one on the cusp of freedom? Meaning, even if you want to make sure that he means it, so right, why not, like as soon as he says it the first time, say, are you sure? And then he'll say, yes, I'm sure. Or he'll say, no, I'm not sure. Right? And he'll confirm, or and then you'll, like sometimes, you click to buy something or whatever, right? And it's like, are you sure? Right? Yes. Like there's that extra mechanism where it's like, wait, am I really sure about this? Okay, good. So I'm really sure. But why does it have to be in two different stages? So again, three questions. Why start with all the civil laws? Why start with Eved Ivri? Second of all, what's the Havamina that Rashi says Moshe Rabbeinu would have had a Havamina? Just teach them basic halachas, not give them the foundation of the halachas. How could you have such a Havamina? And third, why is it that the Torah requires Amar Yomar, that he says twice that he wants to say? So to answer those questions, we have to realize that one of the key ingredients to any sort of success, personal success, communal success, national success, is to believe in our own potential to achieve. If a person sees themselves as very limited, then it's likely going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. They probably will be very limited. And, they'll put these artificial boundaries on themselves that they'll be happy to stay within those boundaries, because that's how they view themselves. When the Jew is told that he cannot achieve what others can achieve, he could choose to accept it, or he could choose to form, to build a certain sense of resolve to prove everybody wrong, or to prove that he is more capable. So as a nation that's destined to be gerim in foreign lands and know of a long, long history of not belonging, so it's critical that Jews understand what we're really capable of. Meaning, the Jewish people were going to be told and have been told many, many, many times about what we cannot do. And throughout history, a stranger is always persecuted. He's always treated like a second-class citizen. And in Sodom, visitors were assaulted. Avram and Yitzchak, when seeking refuge in Mitzrayim and Eretz HaPlishtim, had to fear for their lives. Whenever you're an outsider, whenever you're not someone who's considered to be one of us, who's considered to be one of the natives, so people pick on the weakest members of society. And when you're an outsider, you it's easy. When Dina wanders into foreign territory, she's abducted and raped. Even when the brothers come to Mitzrayim and are fed a meal, the Torah tells us, "V'yasimu lo levado lehem levadam, u'Mitzrayim ha'ochlim ito levadam, ki lo yuchlun ha'mitzrim lechol ha'se'ivrim lechem, ki tzo'eva hi le'Mitzrayim," that they can't eat together with the Ivrim. So in a world where that's like a rule of how the world works, a stranger and a wanderer, if he's lucky, is marginalized to the periphery of society, and much more commonly is antagonized and is unwanted. So the Torah reminds us that you're good, that you have to keep your head up high, and you have to realize that you're Mamlechas Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. We believe that we have this inherent greatness, whether others are able to see it or not. So it's not enough for the Eved to make his declaration while he's in Avdus, because his acceptance of his fate might just derive from a lack of recognition of what it means to live a life of freedom and of his capabilities in living a life of freedom. Rav Zalman Saratzkin explains that the reverse is true also. If he were only to make the declaration on the cusp of freedom, that wouldn't suffice, because the responsibilities of being a free person instead of empowering him, may cause him to crawl back into the comfort of the care of his owner. It's only when the decision is made with full recognition of what he can become, and it's made without being intimidated by the responsibility of life, only then, when you have that balance, is the decision going to be binding. But even then, we criticize the decision. In the end of the day, the slave's life is the most profoundly sad form of existence. But at the end of the day, he's not his own balabas. At the end of the day, he's completely within the reshus of somebody else. And that's pathetic. I mean, that's just horrible. But instead of viewing his slavery as an opportunity to rehabilitate himself, get back on his feet, become a productive member of society, become a leader, he satisfies himself with, you know, the comfort of, you know, what they say, you know, these lifelong prisoners. You know, there are people that when they get out of jail, like in certain communities, when they get out of jail, they just can't wait to get back to jail. Because in jail, you know, they get three hots in a cot. You know, they get three hot meals, they get a bed to sleep on. You know, that's not so bad compared to what they get outside of jail. You know, so there's like this attitude of, okay, yeah, I can live with this, I can make shalom with this. And that's the life of servitude, and a person can get comfortable with that. He lost all vision of what he can achieve. He's allowed his dreams to die, and that's why Ozen Shashama al Har Sinai Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim v'la avadim la avadim v'halach v'kana adol ne'atzmo tirtza. The same man that saw how in a mere 50 days the lowest slave can grow into mamlechas kohanim is now willing to accept permanent slavery. And now he's willing to say, okay, it's never going to change. That's the most profoundly sad thing in the entire world. To be able to, people of vision are people who are able to accomplish things because they could see their way out of the darkness. You know, in the early years of the State of Israel, you know, Zionists don't like to talk about that. You know, we in the Zionist community don't like to talk about what it was like in the early years of the State of Israel and just how much of a chiddush religious Zionism was. There was life in kibbutzim was pretty much a guarantee of a total abandonment of Torah and mitzvahs. It wasn't just stam, not religious. It was very, very, very anti-religious. And, you know, a lot of the anti-Zionism that we see today is really just it's a holdover of, like, deep-seated suspicion of anything Zionistic because of how horrifically anti-religious much of Zionism was, and how things went, you know, on the ground in the early days of the state. The early secular Zionists, they didn't just reject Torah ideals themselves. They tried to tear the next generation away from Torah. They viewed it as like a destructive force. Chalila. Children who survived the Holocaust were put in kibbutzim. There was no vestige of Torah Judaism that was even allowed to flourish. So there was one particular kibbutz where there was an elderly Holocaust survivor who managed to smuggle his family Sefer Torah to safety in Eretz Yisrael with him. And he wanted to go live with his son on a kibbutz. And he imagined the serious nefesh of being able to sneak a Sefer Torah through the Holocaust. And the kibbutz allowed him to come, but only if he doesn't bring his Torah. That was a kind of challenge that was not that uncommon when trying to promote religion in any way in the minds of secular Zionists. And the Panovich Rav heard about that episode. And when he was talking to people, the Panovich Rav said, there will come a time when we will be writing tefillin for the children of that kibbutz. And the sounds of Torah are going to emanate from the Beis Medrash of that kibbutz. And it was an impossible dream, because that's what the Panovich Rav was. He was an impossible dreamer. Of course, it happened. You know, it hasn't happened in every kibbutz, but, you know, it happened. You know, to be able to see a way out of the darkness, to be able to see that there's potential, that there's greatness that can come out, that's something. And that answers the questions we started with. After Kabbalah Satorah, Hashem tells us about how we conceive of avdus. Unlike most people, we don't view avdus as what you are or how you were born, right? Slavery, from a historical perspective, from a secular perspective, is like there's a lower class of society, whether it's by virtue of the color of their skin or any other artificial thing that people make up, and therefore they're bound to be avadim, and they're born into it, and their grandchildren are going to be avadim, and their great grandchildren are going to be avadim. That's not the way we view evidently, at least. It's not the way we view avdus. It's a stop on the path to rehabilitation, and that's the appropriate follow up to Kabbalah Satorah, because it helps us define what a Jew is supposed to be. The Halacha tells us no matter what life throws our way, you could rise up and you can fulfill your destiny as a Mamlechas Kohen and Vagai Kadosh. And that might be why it's so critical for Moshe to articulate all of the details of the halachos of the Torah. You know, we've outlined that we can achieve greatness, but how does one go about doing that? So there's one tool that we've always had at our disposal that serves to break all class barriers. Like every society, Judaism recognizes higher class and lower class people, right? There are Kohanim, Levim, Israelim, Gerim, Nesinim, Kutim, Mamzerim. But then there's one thing, there's one factor, just one factor, that could override all of that. That could take the person who's on the lowest level and put him above the person who's on the highest level. Afilu mamzer tamil chacham is kodim l'koyin gadol ama aretz. The idea of becoming a tamil chacham, the idea of learning Torah, that can allow a person to rise through the ranks. It's through Torah that we achieve our status. So Moshe had to be told, don't think for a moment that giving the people a bottom line halacha is good enough. They should become lomdim. They should become lomdei Torah. The halachas of the Torah shouldn't be left for scholars and people who study law on a deep level. It's in the domain of every Jew, because through the detailed learning of halacha and of Torah, that's how a poor Jew who has no respect from anybody can write a sefer like the Ketos HaChoshen, which competes with the work of the wealthy and respected chief rabbi of a great community like the Nesivos HaMishpat. You know a little bit about the Ketos and Nesivos, you know about them, they're equals, right? The Ketos and Nesivos, they argue in Chosh HaMishpat about whatever. But the Ketos was dirt poor, he had nothing. And the Nesivos was a very wealthy, respected rabbi, right? So but Torah is the great equalizer. Torah brings people onto the same level, and it's important to have hasagos. I had the opportunity last night. One of the good things about my job is I get to talk to a lot of chashma people a lot of times. So they had me do this thing for mechanchim. It was a Zoom session for mechanchim, and it was basically I was moderating a discussion between Rabbi Matenki from Chicago, Rabbi Kamenetsky from DRS, and Rav Twersky from Yeshiva University. And, moderating a discussion, they gave me the questions to ask, they gave me a script. It was like a monkey could have done what I did. But, I still got the schmooze with Rabbi Kamenetsky, Rabbi Matenki, and Rabbi Twersky. It's funny, you have to introduce Rabbi Twersky by the distinguished professor or chair of whatever, it's like, come on, that's so I said, and he's also Rav Twersky, let's keep in mind that. Where was I going? Oh, so they were talking about educating high school kids, and one of the themes that kept coming through is to inspire the kids to believe in themselves, to believe that they're capable. I saw online, someone posted a picture of it must have been from some Jewish newspaper or something, that I don't even remember what the question was, but Tamir Goodman told a Maisa. Tamir Goodman? Yeah, basketball player. So he was a basketball player, now he's a basketball trainer, I think, something like that. So anyway, he told a Maisa. I thought it was Gvaldika Maisa. He said that he was in the huddle. I don't know what the context was, whether it was when he was in college or whatever. But he was in the huddle. It was a timeout. There were 2 seconds left in the game. And he was about to go to the foul line to shoot 2 shots at the end of the game. And the whole game was on the line. And there was the timeout, ice the shooter, right? So he was in the huddle, and he was jumping out of his skin. He was so nervous. And he said the way the coach started the meeting was like, okay, guys, after Tamir hits these 2 shots, we're going to go straight to a full court press. And he was like, what just happened? that it was taken for granted. Yeah, of course you could do that. Of course, we have absolute confidence that you're going to do that. And sometimes just believing in people, just giving that sense of confidence that a person, he said, then there was no doubt. You know, the coach believed that it was going to happen. Of course it was going to happen. I think at the end of the story, he actually did hit the two shots. It would have been a funny story if he didn't, but he did. And that's the avoda for those who are going to be mechanchim, and even those who aren't going to be mechanchim. God willing, everyone should be parents and should be people who are mashpia and your chaverim and your communities. That's important, that people should realize that there's the opportunity for greatness. So often we just satisfy ourselves with I'm not going to go into my whole Super Bowl schmooze again, but like we just satisfy ourselves with whatever limitations have just been accepted over time. And we shouldn't. We should look for more. We should look to achieve greatness. Okay.